ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do regional trains and level crossings need better lighting to save lives? In 30 seconds, you'll meet someone who's been campaigning for strobe or beacon lighting at train crossings to prevent deaths. Also, over the past fortnight on Australia Wide, you might have heard tiny homes and sleeping pods being put forward as potential solutions to our housing shortage. Well, what about houseboats? Should you be allowed to live on a houseboat on the Murray, for example? More on that in 5 minutes. G'day, Jono Kendall bringing you Australia Wide from Gunai Kurnai country in Sale, Victoria, broadcasting on your radio, online and through the ABC Listen app. Do you think trains and train crossings in regional areas need better lighting? One woman's been fighting for better railway lighting since her brother and two of his friends were killed at a level crossing in the year 2000. Lara Jensen from Mount Magnet, 6 hours northeast of Perth in WA, says authorities are taking too long to make life-saving changes. G'day, Lara. What would you like to see changed about how trains and train crossings are lit at night?
Right. Well, first of all, I'd put rotating beacons on the roofs of all locomotives and side lighting down the lengths of all trains, the rolling stock of all trains, and that's passenger and freight trains. I also believe that in some fairly notorious crossings that are on obtuse angles or are poorly designed, low-cost solar-powered flashing warning lights are required. So we believe that stop signs are the bare minimum for the road-rail interface, especially when you look at how catastrophic the consequences can be of a collision between a road vehicle and a train.
Because a lot of these crossings in regional areas, not only do they not have boom gates, but they don't have stop signs, they have give way signs. So you're calling for all of those give way signs to be replaced with stop signs. Do you think better lighting would have saved your brother's life?
Absolutely. And we know this because as part of the coronial findings, the train driver gave a statement and he said that none of them looked up. They did not see the train. And I mean, to help your listeners understand the circumstances of my brother's accident, spraying was taking place in surrounding paddocks where they were in the WA wheat belt. And so there was a conflicting light scenario on dark. And as you know, like it is with jet planes and aeroplanes, distinguishing how far a train away is difficult in that sort of situation. So, you know, there were no drugs, alcohol or speed involved in that accident. They simply did not see the train, and that came straight from the train driver.
Well, the Office of the National Rail Safety Regulator declined an interview about this, about better lighting on trains and at crossings, but they have given us a statement saying research is ongoing around better lighting. It says it's developing a level crossings and train visibility code of practice, and a final draft will be finished by the middle of this year. Do you think that's progress?
No, not really. It's been too slow. And just to give you some feedback on that particular code of practice that they have referenced, it is specifically on level crossings and train visibility. We had a briefing with the Office of the National Regulator just recently, only in the last couple of weeks. In its current form, it's nothing more than a non-binding code devoid of any enforceability measures for non-compliant rail operators. And it leaves the decision-making of train and rolling stock visibility solely to railway stakeholders, which is not good enough. Not in this day and age.
All right. Well, this statement from the Rail Safety Regulator says a code of practice approved by ministers would have legal standing and is applicable in a proceeding for an offence against rail safety national law. It also says that rail operators, including Aurizon and Pacific National, have already committed to implementing this code of practice once it's finalised. How does that make you feel?
Well, not very good. If they're going to adopt it as it stands currently, I'm horrified because there is no shortage of evidence suggesting that train illumination does need to be improved. So if they're planning on accepting it as it currently stands, then it just amounts to more of business as usual, Jonathan. As you know, my brother's accident that triggered a coronial inquest because it was flagged as a contributing factor in the triple fatality and also as a serious public safety issue. So I have no faith in that code of practice unless it's going to be completely overhauled and that train lighting is going to be made mandatory.
Why do you think rail regulators are taking so long to improve lighting on the outside of trains?
I feel like the regulator isn't doing enough to actually regulate the operators that it's charged with regulating. They need to come in with a heavy hand and say, look, this is not acceptable. I mean, we've had two national train lighting reports conducted in the last 3 years that are saying train lighting can be vastly improved, and they still have not enforced it on regulators. So to me, it's unacceptable that the job that the Office of the National Rail Safety Regulator is currently doing, they need to step up and make it mandatory. We are looking for legislated mandatory train lighting improvements and rolling stock improvements.
Lara Jensen from Mount Magnet in WA, she's been campaigning for better lighting on trains and at level crossings since the death of her brother back in 2000.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Thanks for tuning in. You're on Australia Wide with me, Jono Kendall. The regional Victorian city of Ballarat continues to grieve the loss of three women, allegedly murdered by men this year. Now, in what's described as another blow for the community, a men's behaviour change program will stop taking court-mandated referrals after a decision by the Magistrates Court of Victoria. Lexi Junawick has the details.
Child and Family Services Ballarat, or CAFS, has run its 20-week men's behaviour change program for decades with the aim of harm reduction. For the past 4 years, it's been taking court-mandated referrals. But from the end of next month, that will stop after the Magistrates Court of Victoria chose not to extend its current court-mandated counselling order programs.
We think at this point of a national crisis, to cease this program is shocking.
That's CAFS CEO Wendy Sturgis. She says the decision from the court couldn't come at a worse time for the Ballarat region, which has been rocked by the alleged murders of Rebecca Young, Samantha Murphy and Hannah Maguire, all in 2024.
What does this mean and say to the people of the Central Highlands? Where does that leave us? Where does it leave women and children in safety to known perpetrators of violence?
The court has assured there hasn't been a funding cut, but says the current program doesn't meet the needs of a substantial part of the community. This morning, Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen assured the Attorney General will meet with court representatives.
We need to make sure that there's a continuation of these services for all women who are seeking who go through the court system for their safety, but also for the men who have caused the violence to understand their behaviour.
Back in Ballarat, a facilitator of CAFS's Men's Behaviour Change Program, Karina Joy, says over the past month there's been a 40% jump in overall demand for the program, and while it will continue to take voluntary referrals, she fears the axing of the current court-mandated model will put women, children and men themselves at risk.
We're trying to skill these men up so that their partners, their kids, the people around them are safe. And so that they're safe as well, and that they're living a life that they can be comfortable and proud of.
Ms. Joy also wants to see further work in the gendered violence prevention space.
Our program comes in when things have happened. It's too late. We need to be doing something before men end up being referred to us. And that's on everybody in our community.
That call is partially being answered by a fledgling program by Women's Health Grampians dubbed the Men's Initiative. The program is based on the Working Together with Men model developed by Shelley Hewson Munro at RMIT University, which describes itself as engaging men at the grassroots in efforts to prevent violence against women. Luke Baker is WHG's Gender Equality Advisor, Masculinities, and spearheads the program.
We run through three educative pieces that are around 3 hours each, where we flesh out with the men what the problem is, where violence comes from, what the drivers of violence are, what the solutions are, And then at the end of that, we ask the men to engage in a community activity of their choosing that addresses those drivers of violence in their own community.
He says the initiative is now looking to expand into other parts of Victoria, including Ballarat.
Our work seeks to prevent the harm before it's occurred. And the work we're doing with men is really around shifting the lens that we look at this through and changing that paradigm.
That was Luke Baker from Women's Health Grampians, ending that report from Lexi Junawick. And if you or someone you know needs support, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. Or, of course, if it's an emergency, call 000. Many of us dream of a retirement travelling around Australia in a motorhome or maybe towing a caravan. Well, how about living and travelling on a houseboat on the River Murray? According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, more than 29,000 houseboats and cabins were counted across Australia in the 2021 census. That's up nearly 12% in 8 years. ABC Mildura Swan Hill reporter Emil Pavlich is looking into the role houseboats could play within Australia's housing crisis. He filed this report.
Retiree Bill Phillips doesn't receive rates, water or electricity bills. He lives off-grid with his pup Marley in a permanent houseboat community in northwest Victoria called Bruce's Bend. He says it's mostly retirees within the privately owned mooring site.
My sort of age and older, I'm 67. The oldest is Don, who's 96, just down there, fit as a fiddle. Unbelievable. Everybody here has, you know, got their own little piece of, history. Everybody's got a story.
Bill spent years working on water and environmental policy in government and wanted to fulfil a dream of living on a houseboat somewhere in Australia's inland river system, the Murray-Darling Basin.
I've always had a love and a passion for wetlands and rivers and things. So for me, it was a natural progression.
But the Murray River is under the jurisdiction of New South Wales, which doesn't allow people to live on houseboats. Bill is a New South Wales native, having worked near Dubbo and in Canberra most of his working life. So he lives in a small inlet off the Murray in Victorian waters, where laws are different to get around the issue. He says the blanket rule in New South Wales waters is frustrating.
Why not have a different rule for the Murray? You can apply different rules in different places, surely. Why not have that rule as it currently stands for Sydney Harbour and the Hawkesbury, but a different rule for the Murray? It doesn't make sense to me.
A New South Wales Transport spokesperson told the ABC in a statement that living in houseboats was not allowed because of safety risks, pollution concerns and increased noise and antisocial behaviour. Bill says given the housing crisis, it's difficult to understand why more retirees aren't encouraged to live on houseboats.
People like me, who are retirees, it's a cheap, comfortable way to live. And why shouldn't we, after our hard working years, not be able to live, you know, in this sort of environment?
University of South Australia Professor Andrew Beer, who has studied regional growth and ageing populations, says living on a houseboat could benefit people at different stages in their life.
When you look at houseboats, what you see is they can provide a solution for some people at some point in their lives, but you can't imagine it's going to grow to such a large extent that you'll see a significant movement of population from, say, Melbourne or Sydney or Adelaide onto houseboat living on the Murray or the Murray-Darling.
Professor Beer says there are many communities in the Murray-Darling Basin, including Mildura, that are trying to grow but had an acute shortage of housing.
And if people were able to live on houseboats, they'd see both a boost in their population, but also potentially a boost in their workforce. The Murray-Darling Basin is a fantastic food bowl. It produces all sorts of horticultural outputs. But one of the real challenges for farmers is they can't get workers because there's no accommodation for them. Houseboats would provide another solution.
Professor Beer believes it's a bit of a no-brainer.
If you think about it, a houseboat is a readily available form of transportable accommodation. And we look for transportable accommodation all the time and we struggle with it, but houseboats provide a ready solution to those horticultural communities.
In the regional city of Mildura, less than 1% of all homes are available to rent. Some real estate agents are even reporting not having a single rental available.
Out in those other places is, smoke and mirrors.
Bill Phillips says it surely makes sense for communities like Bruce's Bend to be a part of the solution to increase available housing stock.
Yeah, you don't have rates, you don't have water bills, don't have electricity bills if you're set up right. Absolute autonomy. If I want to go this afternoon if I want to go out fishing. I just untie and off we go.
The New South Wales Transport spokesperson says there were no plans to change transport policy to permit vessels to become a place of permanent residence or rental accommodation.
ABC reporter in Mildura, Emil Pavlich, with that report.
All around the country, you're on ABC Australia Wide.
I eat corn sometimes and my mum cooks it in the oven.
Well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man.
ABC Australia Wide.
Because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains. And when it's not raining, it's raining more.
On ABC Radio.
A few months back, carpenter and musician Billy Barker noticed Pacific Island workers on their way to work at an abattoir in Warrnambool in southwest Victoria, and he wanted a way to connect. So he reached out to those workers to see if there were any musos who wanted to meet up and jam. It sparked a cross-cultural friendship that snowballed into a musical performance at one of the country's biggest music festivals. Emily Bisland has this story.
In the regional city of Warrnambool in western Victoria, a group of migrant workers from Timor-Leste went from the kill floor of the abattoir to the main stage of one of Australia's biggest music festivals. All thanks to Kalani singer-songwriter Billy Barker.
Billy Barker has recently returned to the southwest. He's been working with a lot of local musicians. We'll hear some of that story shortly. Please welcome him, though, to the stage now with Olivia Vincent joining as well.
On a boat, now at sea, if it gets rough, must be me.
Billy's a country carpenter who, back from a stint in the multicultural melting pot of Melbourne, was craving cross-cultural friendship and found it in the most surprising of places, Warrnambool's abattoir.
Because I'm a carpenter, I'm usually heading to work at about 6:30 in the morning, and I would drive through the industrial area in Warrnambool past the Midfields abattoirs and would see the groups of workers lining up to walk into the plant. I just remember thinking, there'd have to be some incredible musicians amongst that bunch, like, you know, all these island nations that I knew were working there. Like, music's obviously such a big part of their culture.
Midfield Meat International processes over 2 million beasts a year, so they need a lot of workers. A large proportion of their employees are recruited through the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, which allows Australian companies to hire from the nine Pacific Islands and Timor-Leste when there isn't enough local labour.
Which is how I ended up reaching out to Midfields, the abattoir. So I just did up a pretty basic flyer saying that I was looking for anyone that was a musician. And those flyers went up, and then I think 3 months went by and I thought, oh, well, it was worth a try.
I see the flyer in our smoker room, and then I took one, and then it's Billy.
3 years into his four-year working visa, Jose da Costa was missing his wife and three children back in Timor-Leste.
We want to involve in the community here, because we stay here for a long time. So we don't want to just go to work.
Jose used to be a cameraman, but took up the opportunity to work in the abattoir in Warrnambool because it could change his family's life.
To come to Australia, we have to compete with other people, many people, the young people, they all fight to come to Australia. Yeah, we get more money if you compare to East Timor. We can build a house. We can send our kid to school. This is only one opportunity to change your life. Even hard job, we have to keep doing.
Jose took a flyer, organised his friends and messaged Billy.
And then I finally got a WhatsApp message one afternoon that just said, hello, we play the guitar and drums and would like to jam.
My friend David, he wants to go straight away.
That Sunday, Jose brought a carload of Timor-Leste guys out here to my studio, and we shared cups of coffee and jammed and exchanged songs, and yeah, that was the beginning of it all. And so I carried on jamming with these guys and meeting more of them each weekend.
It's just such an amazing story that Billy, you know, went and put a flyer in the Midfield Meats abattoir in the same way that people used to put a flyer in a record shop looking for a drummer, you know.
12 months on, Justin Rudge, the director of Port Fairy Folk Festival, heard that Billy had been collaborating with a bunch of meat workers from Timor-Leste, and things took off pretty quickly from there.
So I went over to his studio in a farmhouse out in the back blocks of Port Fairy, and they played me some songs, they told me their story, and the moment I heard them play, I was just amazed at how great they were. There was such a natural musicianship within these people.
Yeah, that the festival director, Justin Rudge, said that he'd be happy to give them a slot on the program for the festival.
With only a few months to festival weekend, Billy and Jose got together with a professional percussionist from Dili, David Darba, who'd been working on the boning room of the abattoir. Together, they gathered a group of 13 performers.
They all either work in the boning room or on the kill floor.
This will be, for most of them, their first performance on a stage.
There was a definite language barrier. I had no experience with the Timor-Leste culture at all. They were all speaking Tetuan and a little bit of Portuguese. But that's the beautiful thing about music, is it's the, you know, the universal language.
Side of stage in 1 minute.
Come festival weekend, the newly formed group, Lian Husi Timor, hit the Port Fairy stage in full cultural costume with feather headpieces and hand-woven tais. Their name means Voice of Timor. They even got the folky audience up, holding hands and dancing together. And by the end of the second performance, it was clear that that small offer of friendship Billy had extended had grown into something much bigger and wide-reaching.
I think that anything we can do with the state of the world to create more integrated, more friendly societies is obviously a great thing. And, you know, I hope it's something that we can do every year from now on. I want this to be one of those events that goes from playing a smaller stage to playing in front of 5,000 people on the main stage.
We love you, Mr. Billabacher.
Emily Bisland with that story from Southwest Victoria.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
To Northern Australia now, where the dry season is officially underway. For cattle stations in the top end, it's time to start mustering. The ABC's Matt Brand caught up with some of the young guns of the NT's cattle industry to see how the season is shaping up and to get some tips on how to be the ultimate ringer.
G'day, I'm Jack from Invoy and Riven Stations with Hughes Partial.
How's the season looking at Inverway?
Yeah, mate, the season's looking great, shaping up great. Still a bit wet, but not able to get around at the moment much, but still getting out, doing a bit of mustering and boars, fencing and whatnot.
There's been a few bogs, has there?
Heaps, mate, we're getting a bit of a hiding with it, but we'll get there.
What would be your advice to someone getting ready for their first ever muster in the Territory?
Mate, Regan, good attitude is probably the most important thing. Put your head down, your bum up, and just enjoy the year. You'll have a great time. Listen, I suppose.
Hi, I'm Courtney. I'm from Lake Nash. Yeah, we're going into another really good season. The country's magnificent and cattle are thriving.
What would be your advice to a young ringer getting ready for their first ever muster in the Territory?
Just to give it 110% and, yeah, get comfortable with being uncomfortable, because that's where you grow and learn, and just take everything in your stride and it'll be good.
Hi, I'm Caitlin from Bunda Station.
How's the season shaping up at Bunda?
Pretty good. It's been a bit of a wet one, but we've been able to take time training up people, getting them ready for the season.
And what would be your advice to someone getting ready for their first ever muster in the Territory?
Ask questions and just get in and have a go. Better to have a go than not try at all.
How you going? It's Ben Smith from Murray Down Station. Yeah, we're going pretty good. Had heaps of rain. Yeah, a few fires last year that sort of put us back a bit. But yeah, the country's come back real good.
What would be your advice to someone getting ready for their first ever muster in the Territory?
Just get stuck in and have a go. Have heaps of fun whilst you're doing it. And yeah, don't be afraid to ask questions.
G'day, Toby Coulthard from Brunette Downs. Looking pretty good this season. We've had over 900 mil. Lake systems are pretty full.
And what would be your advice to someone getting ready for their first ever muster, round one in the Territory?
Listen to your head stockman and look out for your mates.
Are you the head stockman by any chance?
Yep.
So some of the young people in the Territory's cattle industry, chatting with Matt Brann as mustering season gets underway. And that's Australia Wide for this Thursday. Remember, you can listen to a podcast of this program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. Thanks for your company. Have a great evening.
ABC Listen.